they did brain scans, and then they identify the brain also as an information processing organ, just like the market is an information processing. And the overlaps are just extensive. If you ask an ivory tower economist to explain that, what is he missing? The experiential knowledge of what happens when the market, the S&P 500, drops to 666 during the GFC.
It's gut-wrenching as an investor.
Right. How can you ever experience if you're not in it? If in other words, sure. Your whole livelihood, your career is on the line here.
Brought to you by Progressive Equity.
For today's episode, I'm joined by former fund manager and author Patrick Schotenus. Patrick has extensive and varied experience analysing and investing in financial markets, culminating in 15 years of co-managing a large multi-asset fund. Throughout his career, Patrick has questioned the relevance of mainstream economics in understanding the reality of financial markets and investment management. And over recent years, he has focused all his time developing what he calls the market mind hypothesis, or the MMH. Last year, Patrick published a book on his work titled The Market Mind Hypothesis, Understanding Markets and Minds Through Cognitive Economics. It is a fascinating read. In today's conversation, Patrick discusses how mechanistic economics leads to damaging policy errors, how mechanistic investment strategies damage price discovery, and the amazing overlapping world of minds and markets. In short, Patrick believes markets are conscious, and we would be better off if we established this as our way of framing how we think about economics and finance. As Patrick says, if mainstream economics is the answer to our problems, then we are probably asking the wrong questions. And that the growing dominance of mechanistic and passive investment flows risk breaking markets' conscious means of price and value discovery. Patrick's analysis contains much practical guidance on how to think about real and financial markets, although he concedes that more research is required. Please enjoy my conversation with the maverick thinker, Patrick Schotenus. So, hi, Patrick, and thanks for joining us today. Can you give us some context of your experience as a market practitioner and an investor?
I'm Dutch, but I studied and worked all over the world, including in London, New York, San Francisco, and Singapore. And I actually started off in banking in the UK, doing credit analysis for personal and corporate loans, mostly paper-based because they hardly used spreadsheets back then. So that tells you how old I am. So dissecting balance sheet, cash flow statements, P&L statements in detail. And this helped me when I migrated later to investment management, initially as a fundamental analyst in the Benelux building and construction sector, as well as the transport sector. And after that, I co-founded a technical analysis desk. And after completing a Master of Financial Engineering at Berkeley, which was sponsored by my employer at the time, I also founded a quant desk. Then I returned back to and that was in the Netherlands. Then I returned back to the UK. And in the final 15 years or so of my career, I was a global multi-strategist and portfolio manager, co-responsible for an 8 billion multi-asset portfolio. And during that time, in those 15 years, I also completed a part-time PhD, which was again sponsored by my employer. A few years ago, I decided to dedicate the rest of my career to further developing the MMH, and now increasingly with collaborators. And our aim is to revamp economics, no more, no less, which also has practical implications, as it is the theory, after all, that creates and informs and justifies policies, regulations, strategies, and other practices.
So that's some grand tour of financial markets and investment activity. Before we carry on, probably it'd be best if you just tell us what the market mind hypothesis is.
Okay, so I'll give you the elevator pitch, initially taking you to the first floor, so to speak. The MMH is a particular so-called post-cognitivist interpretation of cognitive economics and attempts to formalize what investors have always casually referred to as the market's mind, warts and all. And this leads to an improved understanding and treatment, we submit, of the markets, as well as by extension the wider economic system. And in turn, this will benefit society. And crucially, it is based on what is called a psychophysical worldview, which is in contrast to a mechanical worldview that is subscribed to by mainstream economics. The LMH does not consider this mind purely metaphorically, but as an actual reality, especially for investors who are in the market, who know what being in the market means, who have skin in the game, and formally via so-called 4E cognition, which basically views the mind as embodied, embedded, and active and extended. The market mind is the extension of investors' minds, including consciousness. And prices and their patterns are the informational signatures, while market mood, varying from, say, depression to mania or exuberance, if you want to quote Robert Shiller and Greenspan at the time, is its immersive phenomenal experience via sentience in real time. And besides mood, the MMH allows us to address the anomalies and inconsistencies of markets, as we would with individual humans, benefiting from a greater range of tools at their proposal, which come from cognitive science rather than, say, you know, models based on physics.
Investors and readers of people like Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett, is it the same as what they refer to as Mr. Market?
There is always a risk to go too far in anthropomorphizing this aspect, but it makes it intuitive if you think of it as a collective entity, particularly Mr. Market's mind, rather than an automaton, which is the risk we are running now based on mechanical economics. So it is that term, but we kind of look at it from a slightly different perspective than purely, let's say, you know, an entity or somebody who is schizophrenic, basically, because that's what Graham seems to suggest. And we say, look, if it is schizophrenic, part of it is because we have mechanized this thing so much, and that causes the problems.
What is so wrong with economics?
When I speak about economics, it includes finance as a nested discipline and investment management as a nested practice. So let's use just one term, economics, but realize that it includes these. Also, unless we talk in different terms, economics stands for mainstream economics mainly, which is a partnering of the strange bedfellows of new classical and Keynesian economics. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Second, and this is important, not everything about economics is wrong, and far from it. It's just the current mainstream, this mechanical worldview, which is formalized in what is known as neoclassical synthesis, that view that is wrong. In other words, we can cherry pick to keep the good bits, and we don't need to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Right. Having said that, economics has done plenty to earn its reputation as the dismal science. And key is its flawed mechanical worldview or paradigm. And Frank Knight, a very famous economist, called it mechanistic monism. And that is, economics not only wrongly perceives, but also dangerously treats the economy as machine, the market as automaton, and its agents as robots. And crucially, notice that none of these have consciousness. The reality of consciousness for us as humans is a fact that is very inconvenient for mainstream. Specifically, following the seminal observations of Soddy, Knight, Hayek, Soros, and others, the MMH submits first that human agents are conscious, that's a fact, and second, based on this so-called 4E cognition that I mentioned before, that their conscious minds extends into the economic system. So this offers a more appropriate psychophysical worldview rather than a mechanical worldview.
Mainstream economics has seemed, to my mind, to have become obsessed with or even overtaken by mathematics. Why has it been allowed to become overtaken by quantitative methodology and mathematics?
I need to, before I answer that, we need to just add something to the previous question, because I mentioned that they were strange bedfellows, right? So how come that neoclassical and Keynesian economics, as strange bedfellows, end up together in this synthesis, right? Well, in short, viewing the economy as a machine, new classical economics, the first bedfellow, is in turn attractive for Keynesian economics, if it means treating the economy as such. right? It namely suggests that it is, if it is just a machine, that it is something one can control centrally.
Yes.
Yes, control benefits from predictability, and this is facilitated in turn by way of mechanical rules in models targeting predetermined outcomes via central planning. So that brings us to your question that you asked, the mathiness, right? As Paul Romer criticized it, a former economist of the World Bank. The main reason for its obsession is, again, its mechanical worldview. Remember that considering all levels of the economic system to be machine-like justifies control and intervention. Metaphorically, pull a lever here, push a button there, and turn the switch in the middle. Central planners and others who execute this need to be seen as experts and authoritative, like financial engineers. So it then becomes clear that mainstream economics put the cart before the horse. The theory had to be shaped first such that it could justify tractable mathematical modeling by a science that pretended to be exact in order to appear authoritative. Reality be damned. And add to it Friedman's instrumentalism, which was most famously stated when he said, you know, assumptions don't matter. Then to motivate the developing models as tools for those authorities in order to project they are in control. And it becomes clear why mechanical economics and its mathiness has prevailed.
Should budding investors, people looking to follow your path into investment management, should they be studying psychology and neuroscience rather than economics and mathematics?
Well, I'm afraid it will have to be both. As you know, the MMH submits the market mind principle, which rests on the two-leg premise of first, the market has mind, and then mind as market. And this is what brings these two communities of economics and cognitive science together. And we can discuss that further too. But it means that economists can learn from cognitive science about specifically the market as mind, whereas cognitive scientists can learn from economics about the mind as market. And again, we're not throwing away the baby with the bathwater of economics here, right? So I would definitely suggest that investors, especially early career professionals, to explore the cognitive science literature, starting with the philosophy of mind and consciousness. And in my book, I recommend that policymakers, but also investment firms, actually hire a 4E cognitive scientist to help revamping the internal skills of their organizations in order to understand and benefit from the revised economic paradigm. A final thing here is that most of us are not in the position of George Soros, right? When he said that he simply ignored the efficient market hypothesis because he knew it was wrong. Ordinary investors like you and me don't have that luxury because of compliance and regulatory requirements. For example, we need the SFA designation and other professional qualifications, etc. So you need to learn it, but in a way it helps because you can then identify where the weaknesses lie. So I'm afraid your listeners and investors have to do a lot of reading.
Okay. People I would regard as market philosophers, not academics, but people like Ray Dalio, Taleb, and Soros, obviously, who are principally known as investors. Were these the sort of people that inspired you?
Soros, in particular, has been inspirational via his philosophy of reflexivity. In addition, I would mention Frank Knight, Friedrich Hayek, Immanuel Derman, and Georg Simmel, for example. But there are so many others all sprinkled throughout my book, as you've seen. After reading my book in paper format for the first time late last year, because previously it was just electronic, right? And I read better when it's in my hands. But also receiving feedback from various readers, including you, about other relevant sources, I realized that I've only scratched the surface. And should there be another book, I need to dig even further into the literature as well as integrate any empirical insights we hope to find via our research projects. So one example is of a philosopher, for example, who will likely be even more prominently covered is Heidegger. But I think it's very relevant what he wrote, particularly on mood. And mood, as I explain in the book, and as you know, is not the same as sentiment. It's not the put-call ratio. It's not the fixed index. It's totally different.
So how would MMH distinguish itself from behavioral economics or behavioral finance?
It would be useful to first explain cognitive economics and how it differs from behavioral economics by highlighting three points. So first, Whereas behavioral economics studies behavior and neuroeconomics, which we can also link here, and neuroeconomics studying the brain, cognitive economics studies the mind. And the Cognitive Economics Society, for example, states that cognitive economics is, and I quote, focused on the value that people place on their mental states and beliefs. Specifically, cognitive economics challenges behavioral economics' dual system and suggests that decision-making processes may be better represented as a three-system model, end of quote. So this is also what I propose in my book, as you've read, whereby I argue that consciousness is that third or phenomenal system, which acts as an overlay, if you will, for the unconscious system one and the deliberate system two, which has been popularized by Kahneman and others. Yeah. The second point is that cognitive science, which informs cognitive economics, is more internally oriented, namely on mentality's impression, compared to behavioral science, which informs behavioral economics, which is reflecting also its Skinner legacy, which is more externally oriented, namely mentality's expression. Let me give an example. Your impression of anger, that is to say, internally you're boiling, is very different from expressing it, say externally by yelling. And so are the potential consequences of this. And the realization of this is what happens in consciousness. And the distinction between the internal and external can, for example, also be found elsewhere in literature, both in Smith and Schumpeter, for example. The third point is cognitive science, of which philosophy of mind is an important part, takes consciousness seriously and adds phenomena like effects or feelings, think of Damasio's work, to the traditional emotions, which is system one, and rationality, which is system two, right? So, and those are the traditional system one and system two of behavioral science or behavioral economics, and therefore we talk about a system three. So whereas behavioral economics may focus on observation, cognitive economics considers introspection, specifically what it is like being in a market. This what it is like is very central in philosophy of mind, is to be of interest. So in metaphysical terms, whereas cognition, think of, say, perception, is considered mental, behavior, think of action, is considered physical. And cognitive science is largely about recognizing and overcoming this mind-matter distinction.
So your MMH suggests that the market has its own collective consciousness.
Correct.
So what is consciousness?
Well, that's a biggie, right? It is a massive topic. And while cognitive science has made great progress in better understanding it, there's not an easy answer. But one thing is certain, that consciousness is not the same as intelligence. So AI, for example, is not conscious. And as I said before, my book explains in detail, the best way to think about this, and I call this portfolioism, because I do think that markets and minds, as we discussed before, have something to teach to each of the disciplines.
Yes.
So that's why I introduced portfolioism. But for your listeners too, to think about from a portfolio perspective, and in the MMH terms, based on the mind as market. In this case, right? Whereby our consciousness forms the overlay system three that complements your unconscious system one and your deliberate system two. And why do we need this? Why is this system three there? You can use arguments from Kurt Gödel to explain that a system cannot explain itself from within. But let's leave that aside for a moment. I mentioned this in the book. It's more easy. Coming back to the example I gave before, how can you know, you individually as a subjective, the difference between being emotional and being rational? Well, that's easy, right? They're experienced completely differently. And that is that overlay. And then you get into the introspection. And then you can understand, if perhaps not verbally express, what it is like being in a market, having skin in the game. If you ask an ivory tower economist to explain that, what is he missing? The experiential knowledge of what happens when the market, the S&P 500, drops to 666 during the GFC.
It's gut-wrenching as an investor.
Right. How can you ever experience if you're not in it? If in other words, sure. Your whole livelihood, your career is on the line here.
The distinction between consciousness and intelligence and the implications for artificial intelligence, I probably taking you off topic. Does that mean that there isn't a role for artificial intelligence in understanding market consciousness or furthering the work that you and your group are doing on the market mind hypothesis?
I'm not an AI expert, so this is just for what it's worth, right? But still, I collaborate with AI experts like Professor Ron Chrisley at the University of Sussex, for example, who is one who believes that artificial consciousness is possible in principle. But I'm skeptical. Now, for background, AI is part of digitization, yeah, right? The culmination of the whole mechanization trend over the past centuries.
Yes, exactly. And
if it is a hype, I'm not saying it is, but it is now at risk turning into an automation bias, where, yes, we so distrust ourselves and feel so comfortable outsourcing it to IT and AI that we overlook the risks of this.
Can AI attain consciousness as you describe it, or is it just glorified advanced predictive text that doesn't have any of these dimensional aspects of consciousness that you so clearly describe?
Well, again, in my book, I hope I have answered that, because I think there is this, what we may call evolutionary awareness, right?
Yes.
We seem to underestimate the role of evolution, how long it took to achieve certain things. And I particularly make the case that it is impossible, in my view, to, if you get to the point, would AI replicate human consciousness, that in my, or even to some extent animal consciousness, to the extent that they have awareness of this, it is impossible for AI to properly understand, like, the meaning, right, of existence.
Yes.
And the existential threat to that existence, i.e. life and death, to be or not to be, all of this. This is very Heideggerian. So because we have to implement it in them in a way, and we don't even properly understand this, but we are at least aware of it. And therefore, I have this famous cartoon in the book, right, of this computer that runs away thinking it's conscious, and then it unplugs from the electricity in it, right? But the message there is much more important. It's not the role of the plug, but it is this awareness of this evolutionary awareness of what it means to stay alive, or to be alive, etc. And that, to me, is central in consciousness, and therefore I'm very skeptical. Now, the other part, before we forget, I do believe that AI, be it large language models or machine learning or whatever, could potentially help us as tools, specifically dealing with the big market data and analyzing it much more efficiently. But I doubt it will offer direct insights into consciousness.
Yeah.
And finally, because this is clearly a big political discussion too, there is a difference between a normative and a practical approach to AI. And I think, in a way, and I may be too cynical here, but I think, in a way, the genie is out of the bottle to a large extent, and any wish to regulate it is naive or impractical. And I particularly view that from, let's say, bad actors, and you can fill it in yourself who you want to consider here. But they, whatever rules, you know, this has to be a collective effort, and I don't think you will get that consensus.
Are there any practical guides, practical rules of thumb that investors can be aware of, can take from your developing work to become better investors, to make better decisions?
The topics that I discuss make people reflect on what are perhaps topics that are taken for granted, and reflect on it from a different angle, be it money or be it credit or even the GFC itself.
Yep.
If you ask, are there any off-the-shelf products available or killer apps, AI apps, we are not there yet. And we need that. This is why we have started a research program. We want to get it all funded, etc. And there are these examples of research projects in Appendix 2 in the book that I'd like to do, in terms of, you know, early warnings of what, instead of a mechanical breakdown of some machine, rather is, you know, the risk of a coma occurring in Mr. Market's mind. We have a project called Mr. Markets EEG Monitor. So we want, and it will deal with this massive big data, but from a particular point of view, applying deep learning, deep machine learning, and neural networks, but from a other angle than the traditional agency-based models or neural networks. So we have ideas, but my thinking evolved, but I've used this template throughout my career. And I'm just, again, saying this for what it's worth. I've survived for 30 years, and it asks a little bit more deeper thinking about what the economic system is, both the real economy and the psychological markets. But I've seen many people who couldn't care less, and I call them punters, and I can tell you they didn't survive for 30 years. That's all I can say.
So market dislocations like manias and crashes, are they a form of market psychosis or mental illness?
Turn a mechanical worldview, translate it into psychophysical worldview. So you are using the type of terms that I think are much more prevalent. Particularly, remember again, what happened when you think you can just switch off the machine during a crisis and expect no impact, and suddenly the mental health issues turn up. So that is all, you know, why a psychophysical worldview is better. But let's talk about what may be occurring now in markets, whether another bubble somewhere is emerging or is deflating or whatever. I mean, I have no idea, but all I can say is that if this phase in markets is still part of some everything bubble, and that's a term used by Jeremy Grantham, Edward Chancellor, Sandy Nairn, and others, then if it bursts, it must finally affect and involve currencies, right? Because these have been isolated from the previous bubbles. I think that that reflects that whether it is the absolute and relative debt to GDP or interest rate payments to income ratios that have just grown, that if we get another systemic crisis, it probably will be even more serious. But on currencies, for example, I have no idea what role Bitcoin or other cryptos play in that, for example. So, you know, I mean, this is the big question, and I think everybody else, I have no idea how this would play out. But I am concerned mainly because in terms of our thinking, i.e. the theory, not much has changed, and that underlies our practices.
Is your goal to develop MMH to be able to identify future market dislocations?
Well, market dislocations, to a large extent, at least the ones that we've seen, are a symptom of the wrong way of thinking, which is then translated into practices, which leads to mechanical treatment of something that isn't a machine. You know, even the 1987 crash, you could go that far back, was largely triggered by portfolio insurance, one of the most mechanical investment strategies there are. And you can go on and on and on. We need to first start with the foundations. I mean, one way this week I explained it in a reply to a LinkedIn post by somebody. It's not just the way that economics serves its pizza. It starts at the bottom. It's a soggy bottom that the toppings can no longer reveal. What we aim to do is we need to change the curriculum, and we need to get young scholars and early career professionals in to start to understand why the theory, again, which creates, informs, justifies the policies, regulations, and practices, is wrong. And then you can try to revamp it and develop tools that may help by preventing or at least giving early warnings that some of these, you know, mental breakdowns and psychosis and those kind of things occur.
So really, if you want to remove the men of system, as Smith called them, from our monetary and financial system, you need to remove the mechanistic way of interpreting our markets and our economy from that system, which entails removing the political influence over our money, which leads back to this subject you raised just now about Bitcoin. And I'm just mindful that Bitcoin has now, after 10 years of people trying to persuade the regulators in the US, the SEC, to sanction a regulated Bitcoin ETF, that could be an answer to some of the foundational issues that our financial economy is based on.
I'm not saying we don't need regulation or policy making. What I'm saying is that regulation and policy making should originate from a different worldview, whereby, for example, they assure that price discovery is defended, is assured, and that there is transparency. And in regulation, for example, you could think of economics version of the Hippocratic Oath in medicine, right? First, do no harm. In this case, do no harm to the economic system. And this then has implications for the type of monetary policy that central bankers apply, and so on and so forth. So when I say revamp, it is truly revamping, and the implications are massive. But we can't make a quantum leap to immediately the tools, etc., and the answers, right? We first have to ask the right questions. And for too long, if mainstream economics is the answer, it's obvious that we've been asking the wrong questions.
Does your work offer avenues of further research into the area of passive investment and active investment?
Passive investing is the biggest element in mechanical investing. There are other types of strategies as well that are mechanical, right? Momentum investing, CTAs, for example, or high frequency trading, etc. This is all mechanical. So this is what would be a first step. Please view the whole debate of active passive in the broader context of respectively discretionary mechanical investing. But we are closely following on the active passive part. We are following those who investigate this, for example, where the possible tipping point of relative asset under management lies when the markets break down. You know that recently it was reported by Morningstar that according to them, the assets under management of passive investing have now exceeded the assets under management of active investing in the US. So people like Mike Green at Simplify and Chris Cole of Artemis, this is the Artemis in the US, have looked at this, and I've corresponded with Chris over the years, and I've sent him a copy of my book, and I hope we can at some point talk about this. So we follow it rather than give answers.
But it's in terms of implications of the way the UK equity market, and I suspect other equity markets, have been regulated in recent years with this single-minded approach of making sure that the outcome for investors is for the lowest cost product, seems to have ignored the requirement of the market or a capital market to be able to undertake price discovery, which needs active investment.
Yes, exactly. This is the main message of, you know, viewing it in this broader context of discretionary versus mechanical. Discretionary is mindful.
Yes.
Mechanical is mindless. And there is no price discovery, which is what the tipping point might suggest, that at some point we lose this. And as I explain in my book, in the process, by outsourcing more and more to machines, as has traditionally been the case, yes, other skills may come back, but in the market, you're losing the idea which is central. I think markets are for, by, and with the people, right? I mean, if we lose the idea to identify value, which in a way prices attempt to approach, and by distorting prices, it's not just distorting price discovery, but price discovery is no longer about discovery, then we lose this translation of what is meaningful and what is of value in an economy. So there are massive questions when this trend, as you indicated, with regulation, etc., it's all feeding on each other. Mechanization begets mechanization, that ultimately consciousness is crowded out. And, you know, even Jack Bogle has acknowledged that if everybody goes indexation, the market will simply collapse. So, and I don't think, finally on this, some people say, well, it will self-correct, right? If it becomes less efficient, then other people will come in. And yeah, but this is assets under management. It's at some point that marginal investor will not have the impact to let the market self-correct. And we have another systemic crisis.
We talked a lot about the market as mind and less so about the mind as market. One thing that occurred to me this morning is over the years, I've found that I think better. My mind is more active and efficient during or after I've exercised. And if you think about it, we only need a brain or a mind because we move. Is there a parallel here with market dynamism and the ability of markets to operate effectively? Don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yes. Well, I hope it makes sense to me, reflected in my answer, but you'll be the judge of that. And this is where I challenge my cognitive science friends, right? And I have a few quotes in the book, as you saw, where, for example, Lewenstein and et al. In a paper argue that neuroscientists talk about, you know, the division of labor and efficiency and production and consumption and currencies. And I use other quotes from cognitive scientists as well, which imply, whether they do this subliminally or not, they imply that they think about the mind as some kind of a market.
Yes.
And this is my whole point, that here we have this bridging already occurring where you can cherry pick the right pieces of economics to explain the mind as market, and then cherry pick from cognitive science the pieces that can explain the market as mind. And to bring these communities together, they kind of have to see this. And there is research by Fettes. I have a reference in the book that where they did brain scans, and then they identify the brain also as an information processing organ, just like the market is an information processing. And the overlaps are just extensive. They're massive. But people don't, because they're, you know, people talk about interdisciplinary research. Yeah, that's what we should aim for. But it's extremely hard because it means you need to understand the literature across these disciplines. And most academics don't because they're already so overloaded with their own literature. But this point is very important, and everybody can experience what you do. So when you say after exercise, this reflects the embodiment of your mind, right? The first E of 4E cognition. George Soros' famous back pains informed his decision making. That's another example of embedded mind. And everybody, I think, all your listeners will probably have experienced the conflict between your emotions and your logic. Particularly, for example, when you want to buy a luxurious item like a car, your emotions tell you it's a beautiful, fantastic car, but your rationality tells you it had a terrible safety score or something.
Yeah.
So there is this battle, this competition and cooperation between system one and system two going on all the time. Yes, the mind as market, I think, is the correct framework, just like the market as mind is the right framework, respectively for cognitive science and economics.
How does your work compare with complexity theory?
It relates very strongly there. There are many, Brian Arthur of the Santa Fe Institute, for example, who have argued that markets are complex adaptive systems. Similarly, there are many who have argued this for minds. Only a few, however, have argued that both are complex adaptive systems, Hayek most prominently.
Yes.
And again, for your listeners, why Hayek? Because he wrote The Sensory Order, which is about minds. And then, of course, he had his academic work, which is about markets. And he recognized the complexity in both. The market mind principle, which is part of the MMH. So market as mind and mind as market, obviously makes this case too, but we need to explore this much more formally. On that note, one of my collaborators and the author of the intermezzo in my book is Professor Scott Kelso, and he's a pioneer in both complexity theory and neuroscience. Specifically, he's one of the originators of what is known as coordination dynamics, which studies especially the coordination, as in self-organization of such systems. And he and I, together with Sam Johnson, who is a cognitive economist, are about to submit a paper along those lines. But to conclude, the nervous system, the rest of your body, and the environment, including the technologies you use, are coupled across numerous spatial and temporal scales in such a way that they form a single complex adaptive system.
Fascinating. Patrick, thank you so much for spending the time today. I found it absolutely fascinating. Can we just finish? How do people learn more about your work? Obviously, they can read your book, which I'll put the details on the show notes to. How do they keep in touch with you and hear about your future research projects?
First, I would suggest they buy my book. If they like it, they can sign up for the course that we plan to derive from the book. They can visit our website as well, www.marketmind.org. And finally, I regularly post on LinkedIn, where we also have an MMH group. And they, if they want to engage, just reply, etc. And if there are those who want to support, because we're establishing this research center, the Market Mind Center in the Edinburgh Futures Institute, they can just contact me. Thank you, Jeremy, for offering me the opportunity to talk about this, which is my favorite activity, you know, just to explore and discuss this, etc. So thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Brought to you by Progressive Equity.